I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. You may have noticed a bunch of ads for cryptocurrency during the Super Bowl this month. Here's one for Crypto.com featuring Matt Damon.
History is filled with almosts, with those who almost adventured, who almost achieved, but ultimately, for them, it proved to be too much. Then there are others, the ones who embrace the moment and commit. And in these moments of truth, these men and women, these mere mortals, just like you and me, as they peer over the edge, they calm their minds and steel their nerves with four simple words that have been whispered by the intrepid since the time of the Romans. Fortune favors the brave.
Cryptocurrencies are relatively new, started with the launch of Bitcoin a dozen years ago, initially popular with techies, first adopters, and even criminals. And now they're everywhere. Philadelphia city government is considering using cryptocurrency to increase revenue. New York City's new mayor has been getting paid with cryptocurrency. Digital currency does have its share of critics, including concerns about the amount of electricity it consumes and its contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. The New York Times is reporting today that Russia could use cryptocurrency to bypass U.S. sanctions for its attack on Ukraine. And while we're talking about cryptocurrency, what about non-fungible tokens or NFTs, digital collectibles that use the same technology as cryptocurrency? We asked Kevin Roos to walk us through this world of virtual currencies, blockchains, and NFTs. He's technology columnist for The New York Times. He joins us by Skype. And Kevin Roos, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with that pretentious ad, if you don't mind. And we're seeing celebrities like Matt Damon, Larry David, and others getting in on promoting crypto technology, or cryptocurrency, I should say. What does that tell us about the state of this this digital currency?
Well, it tells us that cryptocurrency is going mainstream. This technology has been around for more than a decade, but in the past several years, due to price rising of many major crypto tokens, lots of people getting rich off of it, a lot of hype in the media, and some genuine sort of technological innovations, this has become the kind of thing that people are talking about everywhere, even outside the tech world. According to one survey, about 20% of Americans and 36% of millennials now own crypto. Right. And the value of all crypto coins in existence today is about $2 trillion, which is more than the values of the top 10 Wall Street banks combined. So this really is becoming a mainstream phenomenon.
And for the rest of us, those that haven't gotten in on the action yet, what is the best, most concise definition of what a cryptocurrency actually is?
A cryptocurrency is a digital store of value, a digital form of payment that goes on something called a blockchain, which is a permanent, decentralized, immutable database. So I tell people you can think about it a little bit like a Google spreadsheet, like a shared spreadsheet, except that instead of being owned by Google, it's decentralized. Nobody owns it. It's hosted on a network of computers all over the world. Anyone can add to it. And all Bitcoin transactions, every bit time a Bitcoin is bought or sold anywhere in the world, it's stored on that database, on that blockchain.
And it's peer-to-peer, right? There's no Federal Reserve. There's no central bank.
Right. That is the primary characteristic of crypto and of blockchains. Nobody owns them. Nobody can shut them down. They are distributed. They are decentralized. They are owned by a network of computers all over the world. And there's no Federal Reserve for crypto.
Well, as you mentioned, it's been around for about a dozen years. When it was launched, I guess it was Bitcoin, back in 2009. What was the sort of early promise of Bitcoin, of digital currency?
Well, Bitcoin emerged out of this moment after the financial crisis of 2008, in which people were really skeptical, especially in the more libertarian parts of society, about the Federal Reserve, about the role of central banks in controlling the monetary supply. Bitcoin really emerged as a way for those people to say, well, here's a form of currency that is not controlled by a government, that is not controlled by elected politicians, that is controlled by code and computers and math and cryptography. Mm-hmm. And so it really, its first fans were kind of these more libertarian folks who thought that Bitcoin could help free us from a society in which money is controlled by politicians and could instead bring the power of sort of maintaining and controlling a monetary supply onto the internet with a technology that was created for the internet.
So this idea of democratizing, I guess, what access to money and to financial markets, has that proved to be true? Is that the positive of digital currency?
Well, I think if you remember back to the early days when people first started hearing about Bitcoin about a decade ago, there was this idea that people in the future would be using it instead of dollars, that it would become the way that we paid for things. Instead of sending each other, you know, cash on Venmo or some other app, we would all be using Bitcoin and we'd buy our daily, you know, daily groceries in Bitcoin. And that hasn't happened. That part of the prediction has not come true, in part because the price of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is so volatile that the loaf of bread that you spend, you know, $5 worth of Bitcoin on today could be worth $500 tomorrow. So it's a really bad idea to spend these currencies on your daily living expenses. But we've seen this other use case come up, which is more speculative.
Well, and let me get to that. But in terms of its volatility, is that because it's so new, or it doesn't have its own Federal Reserve that says, you know, a dollar is worth 100 pennies?
Yeah, it may be a combination of all that. I mean, it could be that there's no Central Reserve. The Federal Reserve certainly does a good job of stabilizing currency in the U.S. Bitcoin is more volatile than that, and a lot of other cryptocurrencies are very volatile, in part because they're so new and in part because they have become speculative investment vehicles. People are buying and selling it not because they want a new way to pay for their groceries, but because they think the price is going to rise and fall dramatically, which gives them an opportunity to treat it like a stock or anything else they might invest in.
Let me run this by you. And I have to say, this is, we did a show a number of years ago, and I ended the show knowing probably less than I did in talking about digital currency, but I feel like we've already made some progress here. But I was reading that the more digital currency is used, the less value it has. Is that true, Kevin?
I'm not sure exactly what to make of that, but I think there's a couple things at play here. One is that currency can be, you know, its primary use can be payments. It can be, you know, people paying for groceries, people sending money to each other. But there's also this sort of sense of a reserve currency right now. I mean, gold used to be the reserve currency of the U.S. It was the thing that the monetary supply was based on. That's no longer true, but gold is still seen as a store of value. It's a thing that people buy that has some intrinsic value because it's scarce and that people, you know, have used for millennia to represent value and money. And so there's a way in which Bitcoin, even though it's not being used for many people's daily living expenses, has become a kind of digital gold.
Here's an email question from Paul. He says, can you explain Bitcoin mining? We're told that it's hard to convert Bitcoin to cash. So how are the huge electric bills for warehouses full of servers running 24/7? How are they getting paid? And there is a environmental cost to the use of this digital currency.
Absolutely. This is a real can of worms. So yep, we could spend an entire hour talking about this. But basically, Bitcoin mining is the process by which new Bitcoins are produced. Basically, if you think about it like a network of computers, these computers are competing to solve puzzles, cryptographic problems. And the first computer in the network to solve a given problem gets a reward. And that reward is Bitcoins. So that's how they're paid for doing this work of securing and maintaining this global shared database called the blockchain. And the problem is, or the sort of environmental impact is, that all those computers, which have to be super powerful to solve these cryptographic puzzles, also require a ton of energy to run. And that has meant that, you know, Bitcoin is very very energy intensive. Some estimates have said that it's environmental impact is that of like a small country. So it's not like running a refrigerator or something. This is really a meaningful use of electricity. And that's been a frequent criticism. There's been some estimates that the Bitcoin blockchain uses about 200 terawatt hours of energy per year, which is more than the annual energy consumption of Thailand.
Wow. I know that Senator Warren and some other members of Congress have some concerns about the impact of this mining on the environment. I'm just quoting here from a letter that they wrote. Given the extraordinary high energy usage and carbon emissions associated with Bitcoin mining, mining operations raise concerns about their impacts on the global environment, on local ecosystems, and consumer electricity costs. So there are real tangible costs for using this cryptocurrency.
Absolutely. And what defenders of crypto currency mining will say is, they'll make a few points in response to that. One, they'll say our existing financial system also uses a lot of energy. You know, you've got all these millions of bank branches, you've got ATMs that are that are sitting there not being used for most of the day. You've got gold mines and other energy-intensive infrastructure. They also say that crypto mining is shifting toward renewable energy, and that more and more of this activity will be powered by renewable energy sources in the coming year. And they're also saying that there are newer types of blockchains, not Bitcoin, but other types of cryptocurrency that have emerged more recently that use much less energy than Bitcoin because they're built on a different type of what's called a consensus mechanism, the way that the blockchain actually works.
We're almost up on a break here. Dean says, has the U.S. Federal Reserve recognized Bitcoin as a fully fungible currency? Kevin?
Well, it's still a work in progress. The IRS and other agencies are still trying to figure out how to categorize crypto. They are treating it as some coins as securities. They are treating other coins as currencies for tax purposes. So this is a big emerging question. What are these things? How do we regulate them? Are they more like a stock because their price moves up and down very volatilely? Or are they more like a currency because you can pay for things with them? And that's that remains a fairly unanswered question.
And just because we're at this kind of beginning stage of trying to understand how this currency works?
Yeah, and because it's, some days it behaves more like one and some days it behaves more like another. So I think the U.S. and other governments are right now trying to figure out how do we regulate this? How do we tax it? How do we bring it into our existing laws and frameworks? Or do we need to write some new laws?
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with our guest, Kevin Roos. He's technology columnist for The New York Times. We called him up and asked him to join us to talk about this world of virtual currencies, blockchains, non-fungible tokens, something we will be talking about as well. And we always want to hear from you. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always pick up the phone, use the old-fashioned way to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. If you're confused, if you have questions, just know you're not alone. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, our guest is New York Times technology columnist Kevin Roos, and he's guiding us through the world of cryptocurrency with a primer on virtual currencies on blockchains. We'll be talking about NFTs, their potential risks, and how and where they could work. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kevin, how does someone who's How do you get in on this action? I mean, how do you get a Bitcoin? I'll just put it that way. Words fail me, I have to say, sometimes. But go ahead.
Well, you know, I'm not here to advocate for anyone getting into it, and I'm not a financial advisor, and people should consult with their financial advisors before they do anything like this, because it is very risky. But, you know, to get in on it, so to speak, there are several ways. One is you can, you know, set up a what's called a crypto wallet, a digital sort of storage place for your cryptocurrency, and you can buy them on an exchange like you would buy any sort of stock. There are crypto exchanges, things like Coinbase or FTX. And you can also sort of, there are other ways to buy them, but those are the most common ways. People can sort of set up these accounts on these websites that will buy and store their crypto for them. And so, you know, on the easy end, they don't have to do any of the sort of security work themselves. It's the equivalent of kind of opening a bank account.
Here's a question from Eric. He wants to know, do you own any crypto?
Well, I do not. I own a tiny bit of crypto because it's useful for things like buying NFTs, which we can talk about later. I'm a reporter and I'm not an investor in crypto, and I don't have a financial, a significant financial stake in its success. So, you know, I'm not a big cryptocurrency investor. I use a little bit of it to play around with and experiment for my journalism, but it's not something I invest in.
Well, let's talk about NFTs, something that you did get involved in about a year ago. And I'm just quoting from a column that you wrote March 24th, 2021. You decided to enter the freewheeling world of non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, the newest frontier in the cryptocurrency gold rush. And this was an experiment that you ran. And what did you do, Kevin?
Well, I wrote a column about NFTs, sort of explaining what they were and where they came from and why people were interested in them. And then I took that column and I turned it into an NFT, to a non-fungible token. And I sold it on a site that was set up for this, and with the proceeds going to the Neediest Cases Fund, which is a charity associated with the New York Times. And I sort of expected this would be kind of a fun stunt. We'd bring in a couple $100 for charity. I'd get a good column out of it. But instead, it turned into this crazy bidding war, and eventually sold for 350 ETH, a cryptocurrency called Ether, which is today about $1 million.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was wild.
Well, I'm curious, I have many questions about that, but let's just backtrack a little bit for those who are still scratching their head about what an NFT is. And I hate to have a show full of definitions, Kevin, but again, for our listeners, what is an NFT?
Sure. So an NFT, let's just start with the words themselves, stands for non-fungible token. Non-fungible is sort of a word from economics that basically means it's non-exchangeable. You can't just trade it for another kind. So non-fungible tokens are essentially one-of-a-kind digital goods. They are entries in a database, in a blockchain, that can represent art, they can represent music, they can represent a newspaper column. And you can't fake them, you can't counterfeit them, and you can't sort of mistake them for anything else. They are unique digital objects.
So when you put your column up, essentially what, for sale as an NFT, what was it that people were actually bidding on?
They were bidding on an entry in a database. They were bidding on a unique sort of digital file that was linked to a picture of my column, mm-hmm. and that could be tracked, and you know, people could look up who owns it at any time, and there's only one of them, and that's what they were bidding on. I also threw in a couple freebies, like I said, that the host of The Daily, Michael Barbaro, would record a voice message for the winner.
That's very NPR-ish on your part. So, again, in terms of our understanding, my understanding then of what happens is that you're buying the concept of owning a thing versus actually owning the thing?
Yeah, it's a little tricky. I mean, basically, NFTs are a way to claim ownership of a digital file, which, you know, might not sound like a big deal, but this is what's called scarcity, this quality that gives a lot of objects in the offline world their value, like pieces of art or fancy cars or diamond jewelry. And people who believe in NFTs believe that this ability to create just one of something, to sort of make something scarce on the internet, is a radically transformative idea. Because if you, you know, think back to sort of before NFTs existed, the internet is a giant copying machine. Anything that goes online can be copied an infinite number of times with no discernible loss in quality. And so it's been really good for things like spreading, you know, files around the world very quickly, but it's very bad for creating one of something. And so that's the thing that NFT proponents are excited about, this idea to create digitally scarce goods.
So do you know who bought your article?
It was someone called 3F Music. I did a little bit of digging. It seems to be the music producer and NFT collector based in Dubai. But beyond that, I don't know, you know, much about him. These transactions all take place sort of under pseudonymous conditions. People don't have to reveal their names like they would if they were, you know, bidding at a big auction house or something. So it's a little bit of a mystery. But I did interview a bunch of people who bid on my NFT and asked them basically, why was this column worth, you know, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars to you?
Yeah. Well, and so it sold, I guess sold is the right word, right? Again, words fail me.
Yep.
For what, 300? Now, was it money? Was it in dollars or was it in, I think you said Ethereum?
Yeah, it was in Ethereum, and that's a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, and it sold for 350 Ether, which at the time was a little over $500,000, but because the value of Ether fluctuates, it's now about $1 million.
And that was donated to a charity. How did you make that donation? Did you give them Ethereum or did you give them dollars or how did that work?
Well, I was, for tax reasons, because I didn't want to screw up my own taxes, I was basically acting as an agent of the New York Times for the sale. So it was, you know, I sent them the cryptocurrency and they converted it into dollars.
Wow. I was reading that there's something like 30,000 Bitcoin ATMs, yes?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never used a Bitcoin ATM, and the concept is a little strange to me, I must admit. But yeah, there are now Bitcoin ATMs. And I even heard the other day there's an NFT ATM, which your guess is as good as mine what that means.
Why do you have questions about a Bitcoin ATM?
Well, traditionally, you know, the way that you would buy and sell Bitcoin is, you know, on your phone or your computer. It's a virtual good. It's not like, you know, going to the, you know, the store to take out some cash. But I think it's more of a gimmick than anything.
Let me just quickly reintroduce. We had a lot of people with a lot of questions. That's Kevin Roos, and he's technology columnist for the New York Times, author of Future Proof, 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. And we've been talking about cryptocurrency. You probably heard a lot about it, and you might be part of the action as well. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call us 1-888-477-9499. Let me get to our listeners. Miguel says, I read about a credit card that will convert part of your transactions in crypto and that you can pay off using crypto. Are you familiar with these cards, Kevin?
I'm not. That's an interesting idea. And I know that there are now crypto firms that are offering you know, bank accounts, things like you know, having part of your salary paid in crypto. There are various ways that people are sort of trying to make crypto more like the traditional banking system. But I, you know, these things are still relatively risky. It's not like opening a bank account. The bank is insuring your deposits. The credit card company has some protections for purchasers, and most of those things just don't exist in crypto.
Mark says, or asks, can Kevin explain more about the crypto puzzles that computers are trying to solve? Who comes up with these puzzles, Kevin?
Well, they're cryptographic puzzles. They were sort of built into the first blockchain, into Bitcoin, by its creator, this sort of pseudonymous person named Satoshi Nakamoto. But these puzzles are essentially ways to to sort of have what's called a proof of work consensus mechanism. Basically, all these computers are storing identical copies of this database, of this blockchain, and they are competing to be the ones to add new information to that blockchain. And they're doing it in a way that sort of makes it hard for any one node in the network, any one computer, to sort of corrupt or cheat or sort of change the blockchain as it's happening. So these computers are basically guarding each other. They are making sure that one another isn't sort of stealing money or changing, you know, the addresses or the amounts of transactions. And they're doing this through these sort of cryptographic puzzles and the sort of very hard, I'm not a mathematician, so I'm a bad person to describe the actual cryptography involved, but they are designed to get progressively harder as more and more computers compete in them. And so this process creates what are called blocks, which is new information that is added to the database.
Well, let's talk about cryptocurrency as an investment. And you're not an investment counselor, but just as a phenomenon. I was reading that the Pew Research Center said that about 16%, I think you said about 20% of people use crypto, but mostly for investment. And investments are speculative, and you're right, they go up, they go down. I mean, today is a perfect example of what can happen on the stock market. What is the appeal of crypto investments?
Well, I think one piece of the appeal is that they've done tremendously well. I mean, if you know, there's been some recent losses in the crypto market, but if you bought Bitcoin a decade ago, you are rich now. I mean, it's gone up significantly more than other types of more conventional investments. You know, I've interviewed people who are, you know, broke one day and then they start investing in crypto and they're rich, you know, a month later. That kind of performance is not all that common, but you do see people making a killing on some of these cryptocurrency investments if they are able to time the market right or if they're lucky. But I think it's also sort of a story about risk, a story about sort of generational attitudes about money. We saw some similar dynamics emerge around meme stocks and things like the GameStop frenzy that happened a year or two ago. So I think there's a generation of investors, younger people, who are not afraid of risk. They want some speculative risk in their portfolios. They're not just looking to make, you know, 1% a year on their CDs or their savings accounts. They're going out in search of big wins.
I saw an article by Paul Krugman, who also writes for the New York Times Economist, a Nobel Prize winning economist, and he compared a lot of this to the subprime mortgage crisis of a number of years ago. But I think his main thesis was that people really, they don't know what they're getting into, and that there are these inherent risks when it comes to things like cryptocurrency.
Yeah, I mean, far be it from me to question my Nobel laureate colleague.
Right.
I do not have a Nobel Prize. But I think that there are people who do understand the risks, I will say. I've talked to many of them. They know that their investments could become worthless if the market turns on them. And for some people, I think there is a need for more transparency, more disclosure, more reliable information out there about what various investments are like. There are so many scams in the crypto market. But I do think that some of the people investing in this and maybe a lot of the people investing in this stuff understand that it's risky. And actually, that's why they're there. They want the risk.
Well, I think that might be what Chris is talking about. He's commenting. He says, I invest heavily in crypto. One of the things that gets misunderstood is that Bitcoin has been deemed digital property. So it's like buying a house. It's a store of value, and you can borrow money against it with different kinds of decentralized financing apps. It gives the little guys a way to invest money, earn yield on it, and borrow in case of emergencies without selling it. It's going to change the world. So obviously, Chris is a big proponent of this cryptocurrency.
Yeah, and there are plenty of people like Chris out there who believe that this is a radically transformative technology and that, you know, in the future, you know, we will invest in things like Bitcoin instead of putting money in a savings account or a checking account. And that's a possibility, but it's not an inevitability, and it's not clear which direction this thing is headed yet.
Here's a question from Terrence. Are there any checks and balances? How does it not become a runaway currency?
Well, there are sort of checks and balances that are built into the code itself. There is no Federal Reserve of Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency, as we've talked about. These currencies are not controlled by people. They are controlled by code. And so, for example, the programmer of Bitcoin stipulated in the code of the blockchain that there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins. The supply is capped. Many other cryptocurrencies have caps as well. And that functions as basically a guarantee to the people who are buying this that, you know, someone's not going to wake up a year from now and, you know, print millions more of these coins and make their coins less valuable as a result. So there's some guarantees and checks and balances built into the code itself.
And by limiting the amount, there's more control over what the volatility, the value?
That's one theory, but it's also, you know, a move to prevent inflation. And that's sort of one thing that, you know, proponents of Bitcoin say is an advantage that Bitcoin has over the Federal Reserve or a government-backed currency, is that people are aware and they can feel confident in the fact that there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins. It's not that part of it is not changeable.
I mentioned this in my billboard Whole Foods, Home Depot, Starbucks, it's actually a long list of retailers are getting into Bitcoin, I guess, being willing to sell products and get paid in Bitcoin. Do you see that on the horizon or already happening?
I don't see it happening a lot. I mean, you'll hear stories every now and then, but it's still so volatile that it would be kind of silly to pay for your daily expenses in Bitcoin or another cryptocurrency. It's also not that efficient. I mean, we've seen, that the transaction fees associated with some of these things are big. So to send Starbucks, you know, $5 for your morning coffee, if you did it in Ethereum, might cost you $80 in transaction fees.
Really?
So it's not an efficient way to pay for everyday expenses yet. There are some people in the crypto world who think that's on the horizon. But it's, you know, even if it's not a way that we pay for our daily living expenses, it can still be a pretty transformative financial product. I mean, we don't pay for our living expenses in stocks, but a lot of people own stocks.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Kevin Roos. He is New York Times technology columnist. He's walking us through essentially giving us a primer on virtual currencies, cryptocurrencies, things like blockchains, non-fungible tokens. And we want to hear from you as we always do on Radio Times. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And after the short break, we'll be talking about some of the dark side of cryptocurrency. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Kevin Roos. He is technology columnist for the New York Times about cryptocurrency. Kevin, I mentioned in my introduction that your paper is actually reporting today that Russia could use cryptocurrency to essentially get around, bypass U.S. sanctions for its attack on Ukraine. I want to talk about the darker side of cryptocurrency and a place where criminals can do these transactions or even hide out. What do we need to know?
Well, it's certainly true that criminals and dissidents of all kinds can use cryptocurrency in a way that makes it hard for governments to put a stop to that. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing kind of depends on how you feel about various regimes around the world. There are people who, you know, believe that cryptocurrency will be useful for dissident groups in, you know, under authoritarian regimes who might not be able to access the traditional banking system. But it's also true that people who want to evade sanctions or evade, tax tax laws or money laundering rules, that those people can be, that can be a useful way to use crypto as well. And there are some indications that extremists, people who are, part of far-right groups in the U.S., have used cryptocurrency after being kicked out of more conventional payment processors and banking systems and have gotten quite wealthy as a result. It's also true that, millions of people, own cryptocurrency, as we talked about before, something like 20% of Americans. So it's clearly not just for extremists, but it is useful for all kinds of people who would rather not deal or can't legally deal with a traditional bank.
Here's a related comment from Thomas. He says, what has been El Salvador's experience allowing crypto as a legal tender? He says it appears it's become a haven for money launderers. Anything you want to add to that, Kevin?
Yeah, El Salvador has been the country that has been sort of the most the most sort of vocally supportive of Bitcoin in particular. This experiment is only 4 or so months old. It started adopting Bitcoin as legal currency, but it's not gone as well as they hoped it would. There's been some sort of mixed results. It's believed to have lost millions of dollars in reserves, since Bitcoin prices have been plummeting. It's also been sort of rife with fraud. People who are using El Salvador's official Bitcoin wallet have been defrauded and have their identities stolen. Mm-hmm. And this has not been sort of a total win in terms of people paying for things in Bitcoin either. But the leader of El Salvador, who's a big Bitcoin buff, he thinks this is going to turn out well. So we'll see. But so far, it hasn't been a runaway success.
And does cryptocurrency, does it police itself? I mean, how much is, let's say, the U.S. government, looking into these various transactions?
It's certainly a thing the U.S. government and law enforcement officials all over the world are looking at very closely. We've seen, for example, the Department of Justice, busting people for money laundering using crypto. Just a couple weeks ago, there was a major case announced with something like $4 billion worth of crypto. So law enforcement agencies are definitely looking at this. And one thing that I think people tend to get wrong about crypto is saying that it's useful for criminals, that people are using it and getting away with crimes because they're using crypto instead of traditional money and sort of suitcases full of cash would be the cliche. Mm-hmm. But we've actually seen in a number of cases that criminals are being caught because they're using crypto, because all of the transactions are public and searchable and on a database that anyone can see. So it actually turns out not to be all that useful for things like money laundering, and people are getting caught as a result of using it.
That's fascinating. Here's a tweet from Amy. What rights come with ownership of an NFT? Why would an NFT be priced far higher than the original artwork?
Well, NFTs, it's important to note, don't automatically convey things like copyright. So if you buy, so when someone bought the NFT of my New York Times column, they did not acquire the rights to that column or to use that column or to reprint it or to translate it or to do anything else with it. They just acquired the sort of digital token associated with a particular file, a particular image of that. So it's not the case that sort of these NFT sales automatically confer other rights. They can. Some artists are starting to say whoever buys this NFT has the copyright to this image. Some musicians are selling NFTs that come with special perks attached, like a backstage pass to a concert. But the NFT itself does not confer any rights other than the ownership, the provable ownership of that particular file.
And you still own that article, right?
Well, the New York Times technically
owns it. Or the New York Times owns it. Okay. Here's a question from Howard. What does the owner of the NFT of your article have that I do not have when I go to the back files of the New York Times and read and cite your article?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Yep.
So what they have that you do not have is a provable entry on the Ethereum blockchain that links them and their digital wallet to a particular copy, a particular image file of this column. They are the owner of that. They own that particular version of this column. So yes, anyone with a New York Times subscription can go read this column on the New York Times website, But that's a little like saying, you know, anyone can go read James Joyce's Ulysses, you know, on the internet if they so choose. But there are still people who collect first editions of Ulysses and think that those are valuable because they're scarce, because they're rare. So so that person who bought my NFT owns that copy, and maybe that'll be worth nothing to them, and maybe it'll someday be worth a whole lot more. Who knows?
Here's a comment from Christine. She says, I'm an artist, and there is a real issue of people stealing artists' work and making NFTs. Can you speak about the issue of art theft and NFTs, Kevin?
Yeah, it's a big issue in the NFT world because you don't need to prove that you know, someone could have made an NFT of my column that wasn't me. And you know, the New York Times legal department probably would have had some words for them, but there's nothing in the system that prevents people from, say, taking a painting by Picasso or Van Gogh or someone else, you know, notable in the art world and turning it into an NFT without the artist's or their estate's permission. So that's certainly a problem. And some of the leading NFT platforms have started trying to crack down on this when they see it. But yeah, there's really not a lot you can do if someone with sufficient motivation is trying to steal your work and sell it off as an NFT.
Sue asks, if you invest in crypto, how do you convert crypto to cash?
Well, the same sites that allow you to buy crypto using dollars generally also allow you to sell crypto back into dollars or other government-backed currencies. These are what are called the on-ramps and off-ramps of crypto. And there are lots of them. You know, the ones that people are probably most familiar with are things like Crypto.com or Coinbase or FTX. But these sites all allow you to sort of buy and sell crypto to and from government forms of currency.
Here's a question from Winnie. If transaction fees are so much, why are people asking for paychecks in crypto? I mentioned the mayor of New York at least initially wanted to be paid in crypto. If the transaction fees are so high, why would he do that?
Well, the transaction fees aren't actually the biggest obstacle there. It's the fluctuation of the currency. So the mayor of New York, Eric Adams, you know, was paid in Bitcoin or converted some of his first paycheck to Bitcoin. But Bitcoin's been trading down. So he's actually lost money as a result of taking his paychecks in Bitcoin or converting them to Bitcoin. I think when politicians do this, I think we can safely say that it's more of a symbolic gesture. They want the crypto industry to set up in their city. They want the tax revenue. They want the businesses and the jobs that they believe are going to come with all of these new crypto firms. And so they are saying to that industry, I am in your corner. I am one of you. I believe in this technology, and I want you to come to our city and set up your companies and set up shop here.
And I mentioned also that Philadelphia city government and other governments are at least getting in on the act or considering using cryptocurrency to increase revenue. Does that make financial economic sense to you?
It can, certainly. I mean, if you were a city that invested in Bitcoin, 10 years ago, your budget's probably looking quite good. If you invested a year ago, it's probably not looking so good. So I think this sort of way that cities and states are starting to experiment with cryptocurrencies of their own is really, you know, not something that we've seen be super successful in the past couple of years. But it's definitely the case that politicians see crypto as a powerful, not just fundraising tool, but as a powerful sort of special interest, that they see this as being an industry that they're very eager to have come to their cities, to their states, that they want to align themselves politically and sort of spiritually with the crypto movement. And that's become a big thing, not just in New York, but, you know, cities like Miami now have sort of deemed themselves the U.S. headquarters of the crypto movement. And that's been pretty successful for them.
This was an interesting poll that I saw. I believe it came from the University of Chicago. Something like 44% of those who bought and traded cryptocurrency were non-white. 40% were women. 35% had incomes of $60,000 or less. The average trader was under 40 with no college degree. Does that tell us anything, Kevin?
Yeah, well, it is a sign that crypto, which for so long was, you know, dominated at least in the sort of social media sphere by kind of you know, affluent white men, is becoming more diverse. There are signs that, you know, crypto is taking off outside the U.S. in certain countries where it's being used to sort of store value. There are also, you know, fewer barriers. You don't have to qualify for a bank account to open a crypto trading account. People with, you know, low credit scores or who have had trouble financially in the past and may have trouble accessing the traditional financial system have found that they are able to transact in crypto more easily. And it can be a good tool for things like cross-border remittances, things like sending money to family members in a different country, which, you know, can be quite expensive and cumbersome if you do it the old-fashioned way, can be easier if you use crypto.
Here's Brendan, who says, if all these big firms are now getting involved, how is crypto really so different from other big financial institutions? Interesting question.
It is. And certainly there are a lot of big financial institutions who are buying and selling crypto and opening, you know, crypto divisions, and some of the same players are there. I think what's different is that those, you know, these systems do not have centers. They are not centralized. There is no Federal Reserve. There is no, you know, NASDAQ. There is no, you know, New York Stock Exchange. These are not sort of big centralized systems. And so the institutions, in some sense, are competing on the same footing as everyone else, as your average investors. And so I think that's part of the difference. And it's also quite different in the sense that, you know, this is a public and transparent way of building a financial system. There's a movement called DeFi, or decentralized finance, that is trying to basically take all of the functions of the traditional financial system and rebuild them on blockchains in a way that's open and transparent and digital.
What are pudgy penguins?
Well, Pudgy Penguins are an NFT collection that I sort of experimented with last year. They're what's called a community NFT project. And this is basically, instead of making sort of one piece of digital art and putting it on the blockchain, people have been making these series, these sort of, you know, they maybe there are 8,000 of them or 10,000 of them. They're basically like digital trading cards, like you might, you know, see Pokemon cards or something like that. But instead of being physical cards, they're digital cards stored on a blockchain. So I bought, or I was lent a couple of Pudgy Penguins, which are a series of NFTs that people, some people have paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for. I did not. But I was just sort of curious, like, what is going on? Why are people buying these things? And you can think of it as sort of a combination of like playing Pokemon or some other collectible card game and sort of joining a chat room. I mean, these communities all have their own chat rooms, and they all make friends, and they sort of celebrate their penguins together or whatever. And some of these have become quite valuable. There's a NFT series called the Bored Ape Yacht Club, which is a series of monkey cartoons, some of which have traded hands for millions of dollars. So people, in some sense, are paying to get into this exclusive club and hopefully making some money when they sell later.
You also wrote about a group that pooled their money in order to make a bid on the U.S. Constitution. Whatever happened with that?
Well, this group, which is called Constitution DAO, did not win the bid. They were bidding on a rare copy of the U.S. Constitution. They raised something like $40 million in just a couple days. And they were ultimately outbid by a hedge fund manager, funnily enough. But they, you know, it showed that this technology, this crypto technology, can be used to raise extraordinary amounts of money with extraordinary speed. This is basically, they were able to raise $40 million in just a couple of days with no infrastructure at all. And that is a pretty powerful tool. They did not win this bid, but you can imagine these organizations, these sort of crypto collectives, sort of springing up for all kinds of reasons. Maybe one wants to influence an election or donate to a candidate. I think we have to keep a close eye on this.
We're just about out of time. It sounds like crypto's here to stay.
It certainly appears to be, even though the price has drifted down in recent days and a lot of people are losing money. It still seems to be the case that some people want to buy.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times, Kevin Roos, and talking to us about cryptocurrency and blockchain and non-fungible tokens. I feel like I learned a lot. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And that's Kevin Roos, New York Times technology columnist, talking about cryptocurrency. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.